Ladies and gentlemen, we're back with UTR and we have a very special episode. If you're a fan of the show, we've done it before. It's our scene study and we're reading some amazing stuff. So stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
You guys know this song?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Duh. Do you
I've
know
never
this?
Heard this song.
Andrew's like, yeah, sure.
She's like, sure. I had to look at this screen.
I actually don't know the show either. Guys, this is the theme, of course, to Grey's Anatomy, because here on the Unproduced Table Read, we are reading scenes from existing worlds, including a scene from Grey's, submitted by our very own Tim Rodriguez. But before we get into the show, guys, let me let you know who we are and what we do. This is the Unproduced Table Read. Normally, we read unmade scripts and interview their writers, but today we are going to do a scene study, is what we call them, and bring in work submitted by our very own panel that we really like and read it on air and talk about what makes it special writing. We're doing this partly in celebration of our 51st episode, you guys.
Yay. 51! Wow. It's a big one!
It's a big special number.
The way I'm going to pitch it is that we're celebrating the last 50 episodes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's pretty good.
I like that.
Thank you, Julia. Yeah.
Are we going to play the theme songs for all of the things as we go into them?
That's actually not a bad idea. Jules, we'll test you as a producer and engineer in the booth. Okay, awesome. I do like this song.
Clue does have
Yeah, it's very jazzy. It's, it's like elevator music meets jazz club.
Speaking of elevator music meets jazz club, Tim Rodriguez, introduce yourself for the fans.
I am Timothy Michael. Yes, I did pick the Grey's Anatomy scene. I'm very excited to read it.
I'm Roxy Stryer. I picked a scene also. I don't know if I'm supposed to announce it
You should announce it.
It's The Office. It's a scene from The Office. And I'll give you a hint. It has to do with licking butts.
Yes.
Hey, I'm Haley O'Connor, and I picked a scene from The Newsroom.
Yeah. Awesome.
Hey, guys, I'm Adrian Snow, and I picked a scene from Clue, the movie.
Hi, I'm Andrew Guy. I picked a scene from Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Yes. They should have called it The Clue-vee. When Clue the movie came out?
No. Okay. I'm really happy.
I didn't even know what you were talking about, so maybe not.
If it had come out in like 2000, they definitely would have called it that. Yeah. Everyone would have been pissed.
When did it come out?
Like 1980 something.
Yeah, okay.
Same.
Nice.
Shame.
Yeah. Of the world.
Yes. I love the mood we're in today, guys. It's awesome. Okay, so as I mentioned, guys, this is our scene study show. We do this to celebrate great writing that we love because we're a show that celebrates great writing. So I'm really excited to get into it. The way I want to format today's show is we're going to just go scene by scene. And with each scene, I want the panelists who submitted to kind of introduce the scene, why they picked it, what the show means to them. And, you know, we've done it before. So, Tim, we'll start with you.
So I picked Grey's Anatomy, Season 2, Episode 27, Losing My Religion. Any Grey's Anatomy fan, for that matter, anybody who doesn't watch the show knows it's the, as Izzy and Denny kind of storyline wraps up. Izzy and Denny were a very prominent couple in Grey's Anatomy. Speaking of Grey's Anatomy, it's a medical drama, for those of you who don't know, on ABC, written by Shonda Rhimes. This specific episode was directed by Mark Tinker, premiered on May 15th, 2006.
That's why I didn't like this episode.
Oh, that's why, yeah.
No one wants to cry on their birthday.
Wow, I don't have this much information about my scene.
It's okay, it's okay.
Let me get my phone real quick.
I'm literally obsessed with Grey's Anatomy. So
got it.
I know this scene.
All 12 seasons, whatever.
Yes, I'm obsessed with this
17,
scene.
17, 16.
Izzy Stevens was one of my pretty much favorite written characters. She won an Emmy for this season. And it's literally, I just compiled the scene to where it's Izzy and Denny and their entire storyline from beginning pretty much to end. And I am obsessed with it, and I'm so excited to read it.
Great. So real quick, casting.
Yes. So I will be playing Izzy.
Who plays Izzy in the show?
Catherine Heigl.
Oh, okay.
And Denny is Jeffrey Dean
like
Morgan.
Right before.
Yes. Oh, Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
All that.
Gotcha. Yeah. I've seen 3 episodes of this show ever, so I'm...
You might want to watch more after we read the scene.
Okay. It's a very good scene.
Who else we got?
Denny Duquette is playing, Andrew will be playing Denny. Adrian will be playing the phenomenal Bailey, who is the, because Adrian doesn't necessarily watch the show.
I was a diehard fan up until this.
Oh,
and
okay.
I can't for 10 years.
Oh, never see Grey's Anatomy.
I know what's up right now.
Divisive episode.
Haley will be playing Alex, Meredith, and George. Roxy will be playing Christina and Olivia. I felt like Christina would be appropriate for you. And
thanks, ma'am.
Jeff will be playing our fearless leader, Richard.
I'm cast.
I got a part.
Nice.
All right, let's do it, guys.
Yes.
So I will read the action. Denny's room. Izzy's in the hallway, cautiously considering going in. She takes her hair down, then steps into the doorway.
Is Bailey around?
No, she was in here earlier. Said to be back in a couple hours.
Coast is clear.
You look... God, you look amazing. They always tell you transplant patients rebound fast, but, you know, to see it in person, I never thought that...
I have warm hands. I've never had warm hands because of my circulation.
He feels his hand out?
Feel it.
Is he takes his hand?
Warm hands, check it out. I have a regular heartbeat.
Yeah, you do. I gotta go. I would stay, but if Bailey catches me here, she... And, you know, the chief has us doing his prom thing. It's so... But yeah, I'm really happy for you. You look... Woohoo, Daddy! Okay, I'm gonna go.
What?
Huh?
You like your men sick and feeble? You don't dig healthy guys?
I dig you.
Then why are you all swirly and twitchy?
No, I'm not.
You are swirly and twitchy. It's because I asked you to marry me.
Oh, so you remember that?
That's not the kind of thing I'd forget.
Yeah. Look, Denny, I'm giving you an out.
Excuse me?
Well, I'm giving you an out. I mean, you thought you were dying and I was saving your life and, you know, everything was so... So I won't hold it against you or be hurt or offended if you want to take your proposal back. I'm giving you an out.
I don't want an out.
You should take the out, Denny. We can't get married. I mean that would be crazy. Insane. We should date and have a sex. Plenty of sex. You know, when your heart gets better and you're out of the hospital, all the sex you can handle. But marriage is... marriage, I mean, it's...
Okay. It's my turn now.
But I need to...
No. We're taking turns. I've decided it's polite and it keeps me from yelling. When it's your turn, you can talk. For 5 years, I've had to live by the choices of my doctors. The guys that cut me open decided my life. There wasn't one choice that was mine. And now that I have this heart that beats and works, I get to be like everybody else. I get to make my own decisions, have my own life, do whatever damn well I choose. Now here's the good part, so you listen close. What I choose is you. You're who I want to make up with and go to bed with and do everything with in between. I get a choice now. I get to choose, and I choose you, Izzy Stevens. Okay, it's your turn.
Izzy runs out of the room. Cut to later that night.
Denny...
What did I tell you? Visiting hours aren't for another hour. You are no longer his doctor. You want to see Denny, you come back when visitors come.
I would, but I can't wait.
Ixnay on the insubordination.
But it's my turn.
If the chief finds out you were even on this floor...
Hold on, it's her turn.
Yes. My answer is yes.
Oh, now see, you're going to make my heart stop beating. And it's brand new.
Izzy walks over to Denny.
I will call security on you.
Okay. I will come back during visiting hours. And it's prom, so I'll show you my dress.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going.
Izzy, you did good. I tricked her into marrying me. How smart am I?
Cut to later that night. Alex is walking up the stairs, and Izzy is coming down them.
Oh, you look nice.
Thank you. So do you. Hot date?
Nah, this thing is cheesy. I wouldn't waste a decent chick on this. You heading in?
Yeah. Just going to see Denny first.
Oh, okay.
Denny's room, he appears to be in pain. He grips his chest, his monitor flatlines. Izzy's in the elevator, fidgeting and smiling. Richard is sitting in a dark gallery when Bailey enters.
Chief.
Did my internship here, my residency. Came back here the minute my fellowship was done. The day they told me I'd be chief, I was standing right there in that OR when I got the news. Spent my whole career in this hospital. My whole life.
Sir, Denny Duquette died at 7:42 this evening.
Damn it. George, Meredith, and Christina run up to Demi's room. Olivia is standing outside.
What happened?
I didn't know what to do. I didn't think you guys would want me to go to the chief, but... Where is she? She's in there with him.
They all enter the room where Izzy's lying on the bed with Denny.
Izzy?
I think it was a stroke. He was prone to blood clots. A clot could have formed on his sutures and traveled to his brain. It only takes a second.
It is.
Dr. Haught did a beautiful job on this surgery. But I don't know why I didn't think of blood clots. He died all alone. He was alone.
There was nothing you could have done.
I changed my dress 3 times. I wanted to look nice. I would have been here sooner, but I couldn't figure out which dress to wear.
Izzy, we shouldn't be in here. is there are things that they need. They need to move him.
Take him to the morgue?
You can't stay here. I know you want
to. Can you please just get out? I want to be alone with Denny.
Alex enters.
Izzy, that's not Denny.
Shut up.
That's not Denny. The minute his heart stopped beating, he stopped being Denny. Now, I know you love him, but he also loved you, and a guy that loves you like that, he doesn't want you to do this to yourself, because it's not Denny. Not anymore.
An hour ago, he was proposing. And now he's going to the morgue. Isn't that ridiculous? Isn't that the most ridiculous piece of crap you've ever heard?
Come on.
Alex picks her up and carries her to a chair and holds her in his arms. Have you seen Bailey's interns, Gray, Yang? I'm looking for an Izzy Stevens in particular.
Chief.
They all look up to see Izzy walking in, followed by George, Alex, and Merith.
It was me. I cut his LVAD wire. I did it. No one helped me. And now? I thought I was a surgeon, but I can't. I thought I was a surgeon, but I'm not, so I quit.
Izzy.
Izzy leads with Alex and George behind her. Woo! Great job, guys.
Heavy.
Yes, thanks. Great job, everybody.
Let's talk about Shonda Rhimes.
Yes. She is a phenomenal, obviously phenomenal writer. Mm-hmm. She is a black woman, which is something to say in this day and age, because they don't give, unfortunately, black women, or any woman for the race of color, the respect and the opportunity that they deserve. Mm-hmm. And I felt like somebody took a chance on Shonda Rhimes, and she just ran with it.
Now
and
she not has only, a whole night of television.
Right.
not just a writer, she's a showrunner. Yeah.
It was even more to say back in, what was it, 2003? Mm-hmm. When the show premiered?
Yes.
When she first got it, because mm-hmm. that was like one of the first times that there had ever been like to my memory, a black female showrunner of a major network show that wasn't exclusively black people being cast in the show. So it was like a very diverse casting as
Interesting.
Well.
And Shonda Rhimes mm-hmm. does a beautiful job with Grey's Anatomy, because not only does she play with interracial couples, but she also plays with gender and transgender and mm-hmm. gay issues. She's mm-hmm. She's just one of those writers that includes everybody, and I feel like we need more writers like that.
How baller is that transgender storyline on the show this season? For anybody who doesn't know, she introduced a transgender character who, for many weeks, it didn't come up.
Yeah. Cool.
The character was transgender, which was really, really interesting. Also, for anybody who doesn't know, she also has Scandal, How to Get Away with Murder.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how Grey's and,
We the People, and there's one...
Fire Station 19.
In Station 19,
yeah.
All under Shondaland, her company.
Grey's That's Anatomy has huge. Been on long enough to have started Shondaland, have two shows end under Shondaland, mm-hmm. and still continue.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Ellen Pompeo, who plays Meredith Grey, is like one of the first women to ever pay $20 million an episode.
Yeah.
She waited for a very long time.
For a very long time. Yes. Mm-hmm. And for it to be on for what, 16 years?
14 seasons.
14 seasons.
And their latest episodes still get 7 million views. So it's nothing to frown upon.
Yeah.
I think for me, the thing, I actually don't watch Grey's, but I love Scandal and How to Get Away. I think the thing that she just does so brilliantly is she takes everything that makes TV, like network TV, amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, what a great idea to take all of the best parts of, like, a soap opera, but leave out the bullshit parts.
Yeah.
And all the best parts of a medical drama, but leave out the bullshit parts.
Well, to credit a soap opera is because, not to knock them, that is a whole different thing of their own. They have to put out episodes every single day, every week, and they have to do it 365 days a year.
Absolutely.
So she gets to, it's not that she gets to cut out the crap in between.
Exactly.
And she gets to just focus on the soap opera parts that we love.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I just think, like, she's so brilliantly... creates entertaining mm-hmm. TV.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, that's what she does.
You fall in love with the relationships, and then, like, to have multiple relationships that you love over time, because you can want somebody with one person, and they break up, and then you maybe want them with somebody else, which doesn't mm-hmm. happen because you don't have that time to feel that way on a lot of other shows.
Yeah. Exactly. Cool. And for Dippy on for 14 seasons, you'd think that, you know, you wouldn't fall in love with characters 14 seasons in, but you still do. I'm still obsessed
with
this
real.
Show.
I can attest that Shonda is, like, I'm always on, like, very thin wire. I'm always like, I don't know. You went kind of crazy this season.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if I want to come back for Scandal. I had to get away with Murder. And I always end up coming back before.
Of course.
Grey's Anatomy, I did leave because I was younger. I was like 18. And so I was like, you know what? Oh, screw this. I got to go to college. I don't have time for this. And I left for a decade. Mm. And it's a testament that I was able to come back, a decade later, as like in my 30s, and still be like, oh, oh, I still like the show. Like, yeah. Nobody that I knew originally from the show is even on the show anymore, except for Meredith and Richard and Bailey and Alex. And I was like, and I still can get down with these people. Like, I still enjoy it, which is a testament to her writing and to their skill as well.
Also, the amount of scandal that has been behind the show and for it to still be running, like, with some of the actors and comments that have been made and people leaving and people getting paid more and men getting paid. Like, there's been so many different things. And
scandals.
Yes.
Scandals.
Scandals on Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool.
She's such a great dialogue writer. Like, I mean, I don't know if you guys knew this, but the term vajayjay we owe to Shonda, which people don't
realize. Now I hate her.
Yeah, I know. But it's so interesting. She did an amazing interview on Fresh Air, which is, I'm an NPR nerd, but it's a really, really great interview. And she's talking about the network wouldn't let them say vagina. Like, they were not allowed to say it on the show. Whereas they could say penis whenever they want.
Which is hilarious because it's a medical drama.
Exactly. Yeah. She's like, it's a medical drama.
It's like a part of our
body. Like, how insulting.
We should be ashamed. You are right.
So she's like, I hate the fact that we had to like literally create a children's term around the word vagina, but I kind of love
with doctors.
But it almost became a joke on the show, and it was a little bit of a middle finger to the network. So I just think like that kind of stuff, like vajayjay, and this she says swirly and what does she say, swirly and
twitchy?
Yeah, just like those specifics make her such a special writer.
Yeah, or like McDreamy or dark and twisty.
It definitely has its flavor.
McSteamy, like, you know. If someone says, I feel all dark and twisty, you know exactly what they're talking about. You know where it's from. You're like, oh, okay, Meredith.
I want to, like, tread lightly because I don't know, but I feel like she writes specifically to women. Like, do you kind of feel seen? There's sometimes writers that, like, I feel seen, like, my masculinity is seen by them in a sense.
Well, I mean, let's not forget she is a female.
Right.
We do need more female representation in the writer and in this kind of industry in general.
Wait, I don't know what you meant, Jeff.
So, like, when I watch when I watch Scorsese, I feel like he's really interested in the dynamics of men. Like, he's interested in, like, the alpha components of what make men men. I don't know. And I
think Shonda's interested in the dynamics of people.
Yeah.
And people without the limitations of stereotypes. Because... a big thing about Grey's Anatomy is that they touched on stereotypes that first season. I used to be a diehard Grey fan, so that, well, they touched on that. And I remember when Christina, somebody asked her to translate something in Chinese or something.
Oh, yeah.
And she was like, it was like first season. She was like, why would I know how to do that? And I'm like, well, you're Chinese. And she's like, first off, no, I'm Korean. And, like, and she's like, and second off, you shouldn't just assume that because I'm Asian, that I must be this. And so, like, to have that commentary and then to also be able to speak to the fact that the chief is a black man. Or, you know, the main storylines of the first few seasons of Grey's were about the white people because the only two people of color were Bailey and Richard and Christina. But most of the love
and,
story. Oh, I forgot. What's his face?
Yeah, the one who's fired.
Never mind. She was all up in it. Well, that guy.
But I do agree with you.
You forgot for a reason.
I do agree with you, Jeff. I think that she does write with more toward female mentality, if you will. But I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing because everybody is connected to this show.
Right.
Yeah. And I only say that based on everybody that, you know, the main characters that, I mean, this scene in particular, Izzy is pretty much the main storyline.
Yeah.
Meredith lost, you know, I don't want to spoil anything, but Meredith loses somebody specifically in her life. It was very centered around Christina. Christina loses several people in her life. So it is pretty much female oriented. But I think that everybody can connect to a show like that.
For sure.
Yeah. It's like what Ellen...
Go ahead. No, please.
It's like what Ellen Pompeo said. She said when she was negotiating, she said the show is called Grey's Anatomy, and I am Meredith Grey.
Yeah. Right.
And so it was like, like she writes for people, but it is female. I mean, everything is female focused because for a long time we don't, like, as women, especially like women of color, don't get to have stories where it's just like, this is just us being people. And sometimes it does go a little crazy. B613, what was that about? But, like, but, you know.
Not on Grey's.
No, on Scandal.
Scandal.
Oh, boy. But it's nice to see that, like, it's just about these people navigating their world, no matter how crazy they get.
Yeah. Not to mention every episode has an amazing soundtrack. Like, her music choice on every episode is kind of amazing. So,
I mean, it's hard to... I don't use the genius word a lot, but, like, if you're someone who is the only showrunner ever to create a whole entire night on a network
Yeah.
That's you're
unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
absolutely
Netflix,
incredible.
Netflix is paying her $300 million for her stuff over there. So so go, Shonda. Thank you for picking
that. We salute you.
We salute you, Shonda Rhimes.
Thank you guys for reading. That was wonderful.
Good. Yeah, that was
like,
great.
Oh, God, I love her.
Yes. You should listen to that interview on NPR. It's really good.
Will do.
Okay, we're going to read our next scene brought to us by Adrian Snow.
Super white. but as a child, I had a fondness for super white films. So, because they were the only things I was about to watch. So we're doing Clue, which is written by, I went and IMDb'd it, Jonathan Lynn. It was directed by John Landis. He's also known for, I believe, the Thriller video. I want to say Coming to America, but I could be wrong on that. This is just a comedy from my childhood. It used to be... there we go.
She had a Clueless.
Sorry,
pulled up.
I saw her write Clueless. So, like, that's a different movie.
Yeah.
Do love Clueless, though. I really do.
Yeah. I do, really. Now I wish I had done Clueless. But thinking of it. No, I used to watch it on Comedy Central, whenever I didn't have to go to school, because they used to play it, like, nonstop.
Yeah.
And the best thing about Clue, I wish it came out in 1985. I was born in 1986. So I never got to experience the in-theater experience, because when you went into the theater, the actual movie has three different endings. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And depending on which screening you went to, you got a different ending.
Oh.
So you'd have to check the times, and it would say ending A, ending B, ending C.
That's crazy.
And so you would, like, if you had the time,
epic.
You could go.
That's so smart. So much money.
I didn't know that, because I've only seen it on video as well, and I loved this movie. I used to rent it all the time,
mm-hmm.
and it shows you all of them back to back to back.
What is the tone of this film?
So it's a comedy.
It's like a fun...
It's like kind of like a... Because Clue, like the game, I think we take it very seriously. I remember everyone taking it very seriously as children, which is weird because it's a game about killing people.
I still play it. I still have it in my house, and I take it very seriously.
Yes, but the movie is more like a kind of like a lighthearted, like whodunit type of thing.
Yeah.
And so,
okay,
it's kind of like if Murder on the Oriental Express or on the Orient Express was a comedy.
Okay.
So it's kind of like you just. Everyone's just
tongue
kind of
cheek.
Like...
Yeah, it's a farce, right? Everyone coming in
it's
and out of doors.
Big, it's loud, it's British.
Yeah. And so it's kind of like... It's not British, though. Everyone's,
I don't know why we all thought that.
isn't he British?
Jonathan Lynn?
Is he not?
I can check
that. Because of Tim Curry, I guess.
It's because Tim Curry is on that everyone thinks it's British, but actually...
I was more so talking about the type of humor is like a British farce.
It's kind of like a type of... Like a farcical... Yeah. Jonathan Lynn, if he is a member of whatchamacallit, I'll be really embarrassed.
Illuminati.
Monty Python.
I don't believe so.
Well, let's get into casting.
Let's get into it.
Yeah, so I've got it here if you want me to.
That'd be
so,
great.
Adrian, you're playing Wadsworth. Haley is playing Miss White. Roxy's playing Miss Scarlet and Mrs. Peacock. Andrew's playing Mr. Green. Timothy's playing Professor Plum and Colonel Mustard. Hmm. And I'm reading for the elderly evangelist.
Nice.
What is Wadsworth?
So, Wadsworth is Tim Curry's character, so he's like the butler.
He's not on my board game.
Exactly.
Tim Curry or Wadsworth?
You are all the Wadsworths when you play.
They needed somebody to be like the odd, like to be like
yes.
Directing.
He was my favorite.
All right, well, let's get into it, guys. We're going to start on page 13. Is that correct? Or do you want me to read?
No, you don't have to read.
Okay,
that.
Great.
This is, it's version A. So it's in the movie, I think that was ending C. The last one you see.
Uh-huh.
Okay, perfect.
Uh-huh.
All right, interior hall, shooting in all directions.
Oh, my God. In the dark, the murderer ran from here across the hall to the study, gets the rope and the lead pipe. He ran to the billiard room, strangled Yvette. I'm sorry, I don't want to frighten you.
Yeah, you're a bit late for that.
And then there were three more murderers.
So who did it?
Well, let's consider each murderer one by one.
He turns to Professor Plum.
Professor Plum, you knew that Mr. Bodie was alive. Even psychiatrists can tell the difference between patients and who are alive and dead. You fired the gun at him in the dark and missed you. Let me just do this in a British accent. Make it easier. You fired at the gun in the dark and missed, so you pretended he was dead. That's how you were able to kill him later unobserved.
That's right. He was the missing person in the kitchen after we found the cook dead.
But he was with us in the billiard room when we found Yvette screaming. If that's when the cook was killed, how did he do it?
I didn't.
You don't expect us to believe that, do you?
Wadsworth turns to face her.
I expect you to believe it. You killed the cook. She used to be your cook, and she informs on you to Mr. Bodie. She made a fatal error. Don't you remember?
He runs to the dining room, and they follow. Into your dining room, shooting towards the kitchen end.
Sitting here at dinner, she told us all that she was eating one of her favorite recipes. And monkey's brains, though popular in Cantonese cuisine, are not often to be found in Washington, D.C.
Is that what we ate?
He looks as though he's going to throw up.
Are there any brains to be found in Washington, D.C.?
Wadsworth exits from the dining room at high speed, dragging Colonel Mustard. Exterior, front door.
When you saw the motorist at the front door, you took the key to the weapons cupboard out of my pocket.
Interior library.
Then you suggested that we all split up.
Interior study.
You separated from Miss Scarlet, crossed the hall, opened the cupboard, took the wrench, ran into the conservatory, entered the lounge, through the secret passage, killed the motorist with a blow to the head.
Interior hall.
This is incredible.
Picking up Wadsworth as he races from one to the next, the others simply remain dumbfounded in the hall.
Not so incredible as what happened next. When we all split up again, I went upstairs with you. Yes, you, Mrs. White.
He pulls her all around with her as he shows what she did.
And while I was in the master bedroom, you hurried downstairs and turned off the electricity.
Interior study.
Got the rope from the open cupboard.
Interior
and
hall.
Throttled Yvette. You were jealous that your husband was stooping Yvette. That's why you killed him too.
Yes, I did it. I killed Yvette. I hated her.
And while you were in the billiard room, Miss Scarlet seized the opportunity and under cover of darkness crossed over to the library and hit the cop whom she'd been bribing on the head with a lead pipe.
Wadsworth has acted out the whole of his previous speech at virtually the speed of sound, if not light. Only the actions are intelligible. Only a few of the words can be understood, names and weapons mainly, and they gaze at him, dumbfounded.
True or false?
True. Who are you, Perry Mason?
So it must have been Mr. Green who shot the singing telegram.
I didn't do it.
You're the only one left.
But I didn't do it. The gun is missing. Whoever has the gun shot the girl.
Wadsworth suddenly produces the gun from his pocket.
I shot her.
They all back away into a corner, frightened.
You?
Wadsworth smiles.
So it was you. I was going to expose you.
I know. So I chose to expose myself.
But please, there are ladies present.
I'm sorry. You thought Mr. Bodie was dead, but why? None of you even met him till tonight.
You're Mr. Bodie.
Wadsworth nods with an evil smile. They all gasp in horror. Professor Plum is puzzled, and he indicates the first body in the study.
So who did I kill?
My butler.
Oh, shucks.
He was expendable, like all of you. I'm grateful to you all for disposing of my network of spies and informers. You all saved me the trouble. Now there's no evidence against me.
Colonel Mustard sits.
So that's why you told me about the secret passage.
And this was all nothing to do with my disappearing nuclear physicist husband and Colonel Mustard's work with the new top secret fusion bomb?
No. Communism was just a red herring.
Mr. Green looks at his watch.
The police will be here any minute. You'll never get away with this. Any of you.
Wadsworth smiles.
Why should the police come? Nobody's called them.
Mrs. Peacock realizes that it was Wadsworth who claimed that he had sent for the police.
You mean, oh my God, of course!
So why shouldn't we get away with it? We'll stack all the bodies in the cellar, lock it, leave quietly one at a time, and forget that any of this ever happened.
Yeah, and then you'll carry on blackmailing all of us.
Of course, why not?
I'll tell you why not.
He produces a gun and fires it as he simultaneously dives to the floor. Wadsworth fires at him and misses, but Mr. Green has hit Wadsworth, and Wadsworth kneels over, dead. Mr. Green stands up.
Are you a cop?
No, I'm a plant.
A plant? I thought that men like you were usually called a fruit.
Very funny. FBI, that phone call from J. Edgar Hoover was from me. I told you I didn't do it.
There's a sudden burst of gunfire at the front door. The elderly evangelist bursts in, plus many cops. The cops rush in and arrest all except Mr. Green. Who done it?
They did.
The cops wave their guns wildly and indecisively from one suspect to another, not knowing who to aim at.
They all did. But if you want to know who killed Mr. Body,
he indicates Wadsworth.
I did. In the hall with the revolver. Okay, Chief, take him away. I'm going to go home and sleep with my wife.
Blackout. End credits, fade out, the end.
Oh, yeah. God.
It's so dumb. I love it.
But it's like good dumb. And there's like, it's like silly, right?
It's silly, and you know, it's like some of the jokes, I was like, oh, that's really, that's dated. Or like you kind of...
Like calling a man a fruit?
Calling a man a fruit. Or like the little joke about exposing yourself and like that kind of stuff that... It wouldn't necessarily... Like nobody would... Either wouldn't find it funny or it wouldn't fly today. And so it's something where it's kind of like... Okay, that speaks to the 80s, and that also speaks to, I think they're like supposed to be in like the 1940s or 50s. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I love the fact that they decided to do three different endings. Yeah. I love the, when you see the casting, it's like all the big comedians of the day, like Mrs. White is Madeline Kahn, and Tim Curry is Wadsworth, and it is actually a lot easier to say his lines if you have a British accent. I can't think of his name. The guy from This is Spinal Tap, whose name I'm blanking
on. Yeah, I know exactly. I can't remember his name either.
Michael McKean, I want to say.
That might be right. I love how it's... You said it's not necessary.
Christopher Lloyd.
Oh, Christopher Lloyd's in it, too.
Yeah, he's Professor Plum.
The thing is that it's droll. You know what I mean? So, like, even the jokes that don't necessarily play as funny today, they're sort of intentionally, like, sort of British and, like, droll and sort of, like, wry.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like the tone is doing what it's doing on purpose. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, the conversation I want to have around this scene is, this is a good example of how to take, like, a property and make it into a good story.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could argue the first Transformers does this, too. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think it takes? Like, you can take a board game or, like, a property and make it into a story, but what do you think it takes to make it work?
I think, for this in particular, I think it was really the casting.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the writing, because all this takes place just like in the game in the mansion. So it's not like they're dealing with like, oh, beautiful scenery or anything like that. But mainly it's the casting that kind of gives it life, because most of the actors are like classically trained dramatic actors who also happen to be comedic actors. And you can see that, because there are times where they take it very seriously.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to be able to take those moments where, you know, someone strangling the maid in the kitchen like very seriously, and then the next moment like kind of just be really dumb about everything. And I think that's like one of the bigger things. Or even with Transformers, Shia LaBeouf was the best Shia LaBeouf. Even Steven Shia LaBeouf, like those, like the way he was in that movie is, I think, the only reason that movie was successful. That and Optimus Prime.
I think it's premise. I think casting is a part of it, but it's premise. Do you have a story or not?
Yeah.
It, like a murder mystery is a story. That's the premise of Clue. Mm-hmm. And people trying to take video games that have no premise and make them into movies, but there is no premise.
Right. Yeah, what are you talking about?
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Every video game.
Rampage. Rampage is a great example. I just saw that last week. But I think that's why is Clue is a story already. Like every time you play the game is a movie. You know, it's like there's a story that goes along with it, and so all you have to take is character names, the mansion, and then all the weapons, and you automatically feel like you're in on it. You know, like you're a part of the movie. So, and then I think it's really impressive when and that's why I was saying it was farcical, it's British especially, is because that's what I'm most familiar with, is the way that they drive towards the end in this is just great writing. Like it's really hard to have one person do all the exposition or all the storytelling and all the other characters kind of fire in just to kind of fluff it up to make it all the better. And it's really hard to write that way.
Yeah.
You know?
And Tim Curry in them. I mean, bless Tim Curry.
Yeah,
I love Tim Curry.
I love him so much.
He, I think in the majority of the movie, he doesn't say a ton. Like, you're kind of just watching everyone as they go along the mansion. And then at the very end, it's just like him. Like, and he had to do that how many times? Because there's two other endings where he basically does all the same things, slightly different. And the only two other endings, it's both women who are the killers, which I always kind of like got a kick out of that it was never just a lone gunman. It was always like a lone gunwoman who was like, "Yeah, I did it. I killed all of them."
Cool.
Aren't there rumors that they're making a remake of this?
There are.
I don't know.
I'm making it.
Yeah. Right. I don't know if I want to. I don't know.
I know.
If it's good,
leave it alone.
I feel like with any movie, is it good? Like, I know that sounds like a dumb thing to say, but like Battleship to me was an example of a movie based on a game that just didn't work.
Yeah, there's no story there.
There's no story. And like the thing is, I think anytime you're adapting from a video game or like a board game, I think it's important to not take it too seriously.
Yeah.
Because Battleship was like this serious war movie, and it's like you're making a lot of Battleship. Like,
you sunk my Battleship.
Right. Like, you have to just treat it like this, I think. Transformers does the same thing. I can think of an example of like a game property that was adapted in a very serious way that worked. But when they're not taken seriously, that's when it works, I think.
I think if Battleship had ended, I never saw Battleship, but I think if it had ended where at the end of it, it'd be hands out to these kids. And they're like, you suck my battleship.
Aliens playing like a Men in Black.
Yes. That would have been perfect.
It would have justified the whole thing.
Yes. Okay. Then I'd be like, okay, cool, I get it.
It would have justified Rihanna's acting.
I don't think anything would justify Rihanna's acting.
Well, it's just like with like the Lego movie, that's exactly what they do. It's like when he falls off the... Sorry if I'm spoiling Lego movie. Like, it's been 3 years. Get with it. But when he's falling off the... Basically, the desk, and you see him land as an actual Lego toy. I was like,
yes.
I love this movie.
Yeah. Exactly.
Thank you for doing that.
Well, thanks for bringing that in, Adrian. Yeah. That was fun, and I enjoyed that conversation as well. Let's go ahead and talk about Forgetting Sarah Marshall, which is Andrew's pick.
So I was honestly just trying to think of I was like, what do I know that has five people in it? And then, and like all in a good scene. And so I love Forgetting Sarah Marshall. I think it's like one of the best rom-coms that's come out ever, and it's probably my favorite in the last decade. What I think is so interesting about this is that Jason Segel was told by Apatow, if you ever want to be that guy, you're going to have to write your own damn story because no one's going to write you as that person. You just don't look it. You're not that heartthrob. You're not the leading man in rom-com. And so Jason Segel was like, you bet your ass I am. I'm going to write you the best one you've ever seen. So I think that's interesting. And what I really also like about this is it's very different than what we saw on screen. It's a little more dated, probably his original version. Some of the jokes don't land. And what I think is the most interesting is that Aldous Snow is completely different. He is a Calvin Klein model in this as opposed to, like, you know, the musician that he is in the movie. So I think that's interesting to talk about as well. And I think what we'll talk about afterwards is that the one we saw on screen is far superior to this version, in my opinion.
Cool.
Andrew, where does it start?
It starts, so we're going to start right after the action, Peter Turns Away, on 26. And then so... the casting, which I'm trying to remember casted. You got it?
Yep.
Yeah. So I cast Adrian as Rachel, Roxy as Sarah, Tim as William, Haley will be Brian, and I will be paying Mr. Bretter himself.
Great. All right, guys. This is from Jason Segel's written script, Forgetting Sarah Marshall. Peter turns away, startled to be tearing up. Rachel waves him forward.
How can I help you, sir?
My name's Bretter. Peter Bretter. And I'm checking in, but I don't have a reservation.
Well, I think we're all sold out, but let me check.
She calls back to Michael, her manager, who was in the office.
Michael, do we have any rooms available?
Michael pops his head out.
Jeff.
I'm so sorry.
Oh,
okay. I got you. Michael, I don't know. You should probably check the computer, Rachel. She turns back to Peter and flips Michael off, then begins checking the computer.
How long did you want to stay?
I don't know. It depends, I guess.
Oh, well, that's a brave way to travel.
Either brave or stupid. If you have a room, it's brave, and if I end up sleeping on the Kauai Highway, it may have been stupid.
Peter laughs nervously, but Rachel doesn't.
Unfortunately, the only room we have available is the Kapua Suite. It's available for 4 nights.
And how much is that?
$6,000 a night.
Wow. I see. It might be a little out of my price range. Sorry.
Oh, don't be. It's a lot out of mine.
It's too bad. I was hoping for complimentary lay and pog juice.
Oh, well, those are only for the newlyweds.
Right. Well, you have a beautiful hotel.
Peter gestures toward the opulent surroundings, the water, the view, and Sarah Marshall. She glides through the lobby, beautiful as ever, hair still wet in a bikini top and wrapped in a towel. She holds the hand of her new boyfriend. This is William Penley, 28, the best-looking man on planet Earth, also still wet, shirtless, wrapped in a towel. Peter stares wordless, stunned, mortified, and Rachel notices.
Yeah, that's Sarah Marshall from Grace's Aces. She tucked in yesterday.
Peter can barely speak. She does not break his stare.
She's my old girlfriend. We broke up 3 weeks ago.
Sarah looks over from the lobby. She locks eyes with Peter. She smiles a curious/terrified smile and begins to approach.
Oh, God, they're coming over here. I can handle this, right?
Well, I don't know you, sir.
I wish I wasn't wearing this fucking shirt.
It's fair enough.
This is a living nightmare.
Peter looks at her. Peter looks at her like a helpless animal.
Undo that button.
He does. She takes another look.
Oh, no, maybe not me.
But Sarah has arrived. It is instantly, incredibly awkward.
Well, this is a coincidence, I hope.
A long beat. Finally, Sarah begins to laugh uncomfortably.
Please tell me this is a coincidence.
No, I actually came here to show you my shirt.
Behind the desk, Rachel subtly winces. Sarah smiles.
Seriously, though, what are you doing here?
I don't know. I felt like there was an alien trying to burst through my chest for the past 3 weeks, so I thought I'd get out of town.
I know what you mean. William and I are here because we used that coupon that I earned. How's your flight?
I don't know. It was a flight. I ate peanuts.
An awkward pause. Peter finds the strength to look at William and extend his hand. William reaches out to shake. Angle on Peter's point of view. A series of extremely tight close-ups of William's muscles flexing with the extension of his arms.
Hello, I'm Peter.
William shakes with a friendly smile. He speaks with a slight accent.
William, it's nice to meet you. Are you staying here as well?
Actually, William, it doesn't look like I'll be able to afford a room.
I was able to book that room for you, sir. 4 nights.
You were?
Yes, sir. The Capua Suite.
Peter looks at her, confused, but she offers back a confident nod, and Peter goes along with it.
Excellent. And you say that's one of the nicer suites, yes?
Rachel is mildly amused at his posturing.
Yes, Mr. Bretter, I think you'll find it acceptable.
Marvelous. I am staying here, as a matter of fact, just a quick 5-day trip.
Oh, great. Well, if you'd like to have dinner with us one of the nights,
William.
Then what?
He doesn't want that.
No, that's very gentlemanly of you, William, but you two should enjoy your vacation. I'll just be fine in the Capua Suite. Good to see you, Sarah.
Thanks, Pete. Have a good trip.
She touches his arm and then walks away, William in hand. When she's out of sight, Peter nearly collapses.
Oh, you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm fine. Look, thanks for bailing me out, but I still can't afford the room.
Okay, no one can. It's just for people like Elton John or the kids from that 70s show. And I don't think anyone's going to be popping in to stay there in the next 4 days. So you can use the room. You just can't let anyone know.
Wow. Okay, sounds good.
So you need a key card to activate the electricity.
Great.
But I can't give you one. It'll register with the system, so I'm going to give you a janitor's key instead. No room service, no phone, and you'll have to clean up after yourself.
Why are you doing this?
She's here with a guy already? Well, that's fucked up.
Right?
Rachel hands him a key.
Have a good stay.
Thank you so much. Rachel Jansen. Thank you.
Exterior Waikiki Ambassador Hotel day. Peter's on the phone with Brian. Track his attitude. Brian is both protective of his brother. She's such a bitch. She's not cool, but what's the matter with you? Know-it-all guy. Just because you're engaged at 21, you got lucky. I'm a responsible.
She's fucking here with some fucking Calvin Klein bullshit trash.
That is a nightmare.
I can't believe she would cash in that free travel voucher. She never uses any of that free shit. Do you know how many unused Razor phones she has in her closet? She makes bank. Why the fuck does she need a free week in Hawaii?
I don't know. It's hard to turn down a free trip. But what you've got to concentrate on is getting control of yourself.
Whose side are you on?
She is not cool. There's no doubt about that, but you've got to get control of yourself.
Are you kidding me? My ex-girlfriend of 5 years is here with her new boyfriend.
Why don't we think of solutions? Aren't there any other hotels on the island?
She saw me check in. If I left, it would be like I was running away.
That's totally insane. What's that, babe? Oh, wait. Liz says you have no choice. If you leave, she's in the power position. If she's uncomfortable, she should be the one to leave. I don't know. I don't think he can leave. I think he can leave if he wants
hello?
To.
Hello? Hello? Can you talk to me, please?
I can if you start thinking rationally.
Liz is right. I am fucked. Fuckity fuck fuck.
If you want me down there, I will come.
Thanks, bro. Fuck!
Peter hangs up. He sees the valet looking at him oddly.
Your hotel is really beautiful.
Interior elevator continuous. William and Sarah ride alone in the elevator. Oh, wait. We don't need to.
Yeah.
That's scene, right? Yeah. Great job. Cool. Fun scene. So, Andrew, talk about, like, sort of what Forgetting Sarah Marshall means to you and sort of maybe this version of the script versus what ended up on screen.
Well, it's really interesting because I think, like I said, I think the version on screen is so much funnier. I think that what they did with Aldous Snow and turning him into, like, the caricature that he is in the movie was so much more brilliant than this kind of, like, cardboard Calvin Klein model. Yeah. You know, there's only so far you could go with that. So I'm curious as to, like, and I don't know the answer to this, but, like, what happened on set, whether it was when they were filming or during his final rewrites, they were just like, we need to change Aldous Snow. Because he ends up being
one of the highlights of the movie, and his relationship with Jonah Hill later on is it wouldn't have even really been there.
Yeah. Get him to the Greek, you mean?
Yeah. Well, no, but I also mean in this movie, Jonah Hill plays like one of the concierges, yeah. and he's obsessed with him. But it'd be weird if he was obsessed with like a random Calvin Klein model. Yeah.
I think it probably came down to casting, and when they cast Russell Brand. There we go. I was like, what is his name? Remember it. I think that's when the character probably changed.
Yeah, and I think it changed so much for the better.
It's very clear that even from, this is probably like, looks like a maybe second, third draft, maybe? Mm-hmm. That they wanted Mila Kunis for it, just by throwing in that
70s joke reference, I thought.
Like, oh, they probably always wanted her to be in it.
And then, like, because I think in the movie they change it from that 70s show to Oprah, which is, like, so much more relatable for us now. So, there's like, things you notice when we're like, reading through it.
She's got a ton of razor phones.
Yeah, really razor funny. Phones. I was like, I almost wanted to go back and, like, find the proper version that was out now. But I was like, nah, this is so much more interesting. Yeah.
The thing I know about Judd is whenever he pushes comics to write their own stuff, he's like, story first, stakes first. And so this is an example of, like, the narrative blueprint. Mm-hmm. Like, all of it's there. We have, like, the bumbling protagonist. We have the cringy, uncomfortable moments that like are so Apatowian and like so important for this film. So I think it's an example of like if you want to write comedy, story first, you can always make it funnier.
Yeah. Like the line, I wish I wasn't wearing this fucking shirt. I had to just do it because it's like my favorite line in the whole movie.
I think
it's just so subtle and hilarious. And then I also love the moment where Rachel's like, she's here with that guy already. That's fucked up. And it's just like such an honest, true moment that you like, we all would hope that someone would be that to us in that moment. Mm-hmm. And I love it. And I love the fact that Jason Segel just wrote this for himself. And I think that it's like a, you know, for all of us that are actors, it's like, I think about writing scripts for myself all the time. And this is like a great example of it. Really, really working.
Definitely.
Yeah, I didn't know that. It makes me want to rewatch it. I remember laughing my ass off
this movie.
Yeah, it's great.
I only knew he wrote it because he included puppets, because he loves puppets, that's why he has Dracula, the puppet show.
Yeah, which I also, like, I would have loved to do something with that, because I just think it's genius. Like, the whole Dracula musical and the music they write for it is so good.
Yeah.
All the way across the board, like, Jason Segel won my heart with this movie.
Definitely. Have you seen the end of the tour?
Huh.
He's so good in that movie.
What is that?
I'll be quick, because I know we want to move on, but he plays David Foster Wallace.
Oh, okay.
With Jesse Eisenberg. It's really, really good.
I'll check it
out.
It's
a crazy turn for him.
Not a comedy.
Very serious. You've never seen him.
I love it. I think he's a phenomenal actor. And then also Mila Kunis and Kristen Bell are amazing in this.
Yeah, they are. Very well cast. And again, like, we can see the narrative blueprints here first that I think even if you're writing comedy, story matters so much.
Oh, yeah. And that was the other thing I was going to say is in this scene, the whole movie is surmised. In just this one scene, you get everything. They're both on vacation. In Hawaii, she's with a new boyfriend, there's a problem, they're staying in the same hotel, you meet Rachel, you know that there's going to be some interest there. It's like the whole movie is done in four pages, which I think is also very interesting.
It's a great point. Cool, thanks for bringing that in. I enjoyed that read night. Want to watch the movie again though. It's great. Okay, we're going to do my scene next, guys. I brought in a scene from one of my favorite movies ever, Little Miss Sunshine. I feel like this is one of those movies that's like important for me in the sense of like you see it and it just kind of opens something up for you. I feel like all of us have movies like that. And this is was a really small indie movie when it came out. It was shot for nothing, shot by two music video directors who I really like, and written by this no-name guy named Michael Arndt, who now like story consults for Pixar, so he's done a good job. But this movie, again, one of those rare indies that got nominated for a bunch of Oscars and actually won original screenplay at the Oscar. Just because it's one of those rare movies that I really do believe great acting, great directing, but like the script is the thing that's special. I think the essence and the lifeblood of this movie is the writing. Yeah. So I brought in the dinner scene, happens early on in the movie, really where we meet the characters. And we'll talk more after you read it, but I think it's just a really, really pretty perfectly written scene. Haley's reading for Olive, who's the little girl in the film. If you haven't seen the movie, it's about it's a family road movie about a dysfunctional family trying to get Olive, who Haley's playing, to a beauty pageant. That's what the movie's about. Tim is playing gay Uncle Frank. Andrew is playing Yeah, it's sort of important to the...
Yeah, no.
Sorry. It's important in the narrative. I was just going to...
Andrew's playing brown version of Richard.
No, not that Tim's gay.
Playing the black Cheryl.
It's not the character's gay. It's in the script, but it's very... It's very important to the story.
Yeah, it is.
Andrew's playing winning-obsessed Richard. Adrian is playing sort of straight man Cheryl. Roxy is playing cranky wild grandpa. That's his name in the movie. Yes. And I am reading the action.
I've been working my whole life towards this.
Yes. It did sound like weirdly aggressive when I said that way.
Did Alan Arkin win an Academy Award for this?
I think he won.
He did, right?
He was definitely nominated, and I think he won, which is never happens for indies like this, so it speaks to the strength of the movie. All right, we are going to start at the very beginning of dinner with Frank.
Cool. So, Cheryl, I couldn't help notice Dwayne has stopped speaking.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dwayne's taken a vow of silence.
You've taken a vow of silence?
Dwayne nods.
He's going to join the Naval Academy and become a fighter pilot. And he's taken a vow of silence until he reaches that goal.
You're kidding.
Dwayne stares at Frank. He's not kidding. Olive enters the dining room with Grandpa following.
Hi, Uncle Frank.
Olive. Boy, you're getting big. Is she big for her age?
Cheryl nods. Olive, unprompted, walks over and gives him a kiss on the cheek. She sees the bandages on Frank's wrists.
What happened to your arms,
Olive?
Oh, no, it's okay. I had a little accident. I'm okay now.
How's the new routine coming?
It's good.
When are you going to let us see it?
I don't know. It's up to Grandpa.
A couple of days. We need a polish.
Olive sits and Grandpa walks to the table.
What is this, chicken? Every day it's the chicken. Holy God Almighty, is it possible just for one time we could have something for dinner except the goddamn fucking chicken?
Cheryl ignores him and Richard tries to cut him off.
Dad.
I'm just saying.
If you want to cook or buy your own food, you're more than welcome
Christ,
to.
Christ, you know, at Sunset Village.
You know, if you like Sunset Village so much, maybe you shouldn't have gotten yourself kicked out of there.
Ah.
He takes out a piece of chicken and starts eating. A tense silence. Frank tries to get things going again.
When did you start with the vow?
Dwayne shrugs. He doesn't care to comment.
It's been 9 months. He hasn't said a word. I think it shows tremendous discipline.
Richard.
I'm serious. I think we could all learn something from what Dwayne's doing. Dwayne has a goal. He has a dream. It may not be my dream or your dream, but still, he's pursuing that dream with focus and discipline. In fact, I was thinking about the nine steps.
Oh, for crying out loud.
About the nine steps and how Dwayne's utilizing at least seven of them in this journey to personal fulfillment.
Richard, please.
I'm just saying, I've come around. I think Dwayne deserves our support.
Frank looks at Dwayne. Dwayne rolls his eyes and Olive addresses Frank.
How did it happen?
How did what happen?
Your accident?
Honey.
She shakes her head. Don't go there.
No, it's okay. Unless you object.
No, I'm pro honesty here. I just think, you know, it's up to you.
Be my guest.
Olive, Uncle Frank didn't really have an accident. What happened was he tried to kill himself.
You did? Why?
I don't think this is appropriate conversation. Let's leave Uncle Frank alone.
A beat? Olive has stopped eating.
Why did you want to kill yourself?
Frank, don't answer that question.
Frank stares at Richard. He turns back to Olive.
I tried to kill myself because I was very unhappy.
Don't listen, honey. He's sick,
Richard,
and he doesn't know what...
Richard, that's...
What? I don't think it's appropriate for a six-year-old to be
talking... She's going to find out anyway. Go on, Frank.
Why were you unhappy?
Frank glances at Richard, deadpan victorious, and continues.
Well, there were a lot of reasons. Mainly, though, I fell in love with someone who didn't love me back.
Who?
One of my grad students. I was very much in love with him.
Him? It was a boy? You fell in love with a boy?
Yes, I did. Very much so.
This is new to Olive. She thinks it over.
That's silly.
You're right. It was very, very silly.
There's another word for it.
Dad.
So that's when you tried to kill yourself?
Well, no. What happened was the boy I was in love with fell in love with another man. Larry Sugarman.
Who's Larry Sugarman?
Larry Sugarman is perhaps the second most highly regarded Proust scholar in the U.S.
Well, who's number one?
That would be me, Rich.
So that's when you tried to...
No. Well, no. What happened was I was a bit upset. I did some things I shouldn't have done. Subsequently, I was fired, forced to leave my apartment and move into a motel.
Oh.
So that's when...
Well, no. Actually, all that was okay. What happened was, 2 days ago, the MacArthur Foundation decided to award a genius grant to Larry Sugarman. And that's when...
You tried to check out early.
Yes. And I failed at that as well.
Now, Olive, what's important to understand is that Uncle Frank gave up on himself. He made a series of foolish choices, and then he gave up on himself, which is something that winners don't do.
A beat. Frank looks like he could leap across the table and strangle Richard, so Cheryl intervenes.
So that's the story, okay? Let's move on. Olive, how's your new routine coming?
Fine, I told you.
Over the above, Frank turns and asks regarding Richard.
Is he always like this?
Dwayne nods.
How can you stand it?
Dwayne writes a note, shows it to Frank. It reads, I can't. Frank nods and Richard addresses Olive.
Honey, tell Frank why you're doing your dance routine.
Olive, why are you doing a dance routine?
For Little Miss Crab Cakes.
Aha, just as I suspected.
Honey, tell him what Little Miss Crab Cakes is.
Little Miss Crab Cakes is a beauty contest for everyone in Maryland, but you have to be 6 or 7 years old and you have to be a girl.
Frank looks skeptically at Cheryl.
Don't look at me. This is Jeff and the new stepmom. It's big down in Florida.
So what do you think your chances are?
Olive takes the question like a pro.
I think I can win, because a lot of the new girls, they don't have the experience.
Well, good luck.
It's not about luck, Frank. Luck is the name that losers give to their own failings. It's about wanting to win, willing yourself to win. You got to want it better than anyone.
I do.
Do you really? Then you're going to be a winner.
She smiles, Dwayne shakes his head and keeps eating.
Richard.
What? It's true.
I was runner-up in Florida.
When were you in Florida?
Spring break. Jeff had custody for 2 weeks. Olive made it to the top of the regionals down there.
I was second place.
Sherry, you know there's a message from Jeff on the machine.
Yeah. Did you hear what it was?
Actually, it was something about Little Miss Sunshine.
What? Little Miss Sunshine? What?
She runs off. Cheryl follows Olive into the kitchen. Interior kitchen day. Cheryl and Olive approach the answering machine. The message light is blinking, and Cheryl hits it. Cheryl, hey, it's Jeff. Interior dining room day. Richard, Frank, and Dwayne try to listen, eating silently. In the kitchen, Olive and Cheryl listen. Anyway, something about diet pills. But anyway, that means that Olive won the regionals, so now she has a place in the state contest in Boca. Beep! Over the above, Olive reacts with involuntary spasms of shock, disbelief, and then pure, unadulterated euphoria. She waits, trembling to hear the whole message. When it ends, she puts her hands to her temples.
God! Sunshine.
She goes running out of the dining room.
Little Miss Sunshine.
Cheryl closes her eyes.
Fuck.
Good job, guys. This script is, it's so hard to do this.
Yeah.
To write something this kind of dark and dreary, but like it is funny.
So funny. Yeah.
It's so funny. And I think part of it, I know I mentioned that it's the script, but casting Steve Carell in this role of Frank was so smart. Yeah. I think, Tim, you did the same thing he brought, which was just something funny, like true and sad, but also funny to it.
Thank you, which is funny because I've never seen this movie.
You haven't?
No.
Okay.
Is it universe? Sorry, go ahead, Jeff.
I was just going to say, and I want to hear your question next. How did you feel not having seen the movie?
I thought it was funny, and B, having seen all of the scripts, I could see why you would pick this one, because it's so, like, the dialogue is just so on point, like, written, it's just so well done.
Yeah.
But I felt like with, as an actor, like, you can do so much more with it when it's, like, written so much better.
Mm-hmm.
The character of Frank, though, that's just how I saw him. I love the relationship with him and Richard, because I could see that they have this budding thing, and it's not only between like a gay and straight thing, it's also like a man thing, like men always have this budding, I don't know, head budding kind of like who's
macho,
better.
Yeah,
exactly,
testosterone.
So I definitely picked up that from the script initially, which is just a testament to the writers.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I want to hear your question, Rox.
Well, just is it universally thought of as bad parenting to, like, is this a bad parenting move?
Oh, to do pageants?
No, not pageants, to tell your kid about a suicide attempt. Like, is that a, because I was like, I related to that. I think that's how I would have handled the situation.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was like talking to some friends about it, and they're like, no, that's like the part of the movie that is bad parenting. And I was like,
acting like everything's gonna be hunky-dory was bad parenting. Me, because I tend to sit on that other side of the fence, like, when the scene in Captain Fantastic where he's, like, talking about death with his children, and he's, like, just very honest about it. I mean, I I loved most of the parenting choices in Captain Fantastic, except the whole, you know, letting them, like, live in the woods and, like, carry knives. But I, yeah, I think for most people, they assume that that's bad parenting to have real discussions, but...
But it's... There's two sides of the coin, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, and I think they're both shown in that scene because you have Richard on the other hand being like, if you want it bad enough, you'll win.
Yeah.
And
so you're not supposed to leave this like feeling like you're on the wrong side. Like people probably saw both sides.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
I think so.
And I think actually in the movie, because Richard's played by Greg Kinnear, and by the end of it, I think you find out he's a failure at what he's doing.
Yeah.
And you see that it's just, that's one way of bullshit parenting that a lot of people do, and it's like being honest with your kids, and you find out later on with Olive and what happens and all that, it's like kids are gonna be kids, and you got to be honest with them,
right?
You know.
Yeah. And she loses right at the end, and so
and she does like this just like stripper dance. It's amazing.
I loved it.
It's like literally a strip routine.
Who plays Cheryl?
Oh my god, I've never seen this, but literally, that's exactly who I thought that would play.
She does such a great balance of like being grounded, but also being able to get really weird. Like, I mean, my first introduction to her was that weird Australian movie about being obsessed with ABBA. I can't remember what it's called, something wedding. And then also the United States of Tara, where she just gets to play like all over the place.
She's awesome.
She's just such a great.
I'm still mind blown that I thought it was Toni Collette, and that's exactly.
I know. Yeah. It's
like, did they write it for her?
The cover of the movie with the bus,
like subconsciously, but I didn't.
Jules,
I wasn't
can you
thinking about
fast forward too. To when they're all on stage, real quick? Just like fast forward a couple minutes. This is kind of a spoiler. You just got to watch the movie.
Yeah, no, I definitely do.
Like even
Oh, right, and then I forgot that he went up there.
I think we're getting a little off track.
We are. I love this movie. The whole, Let's talk about this writing, though. I think, Roxy, you identified, are we supposed to know that it's good parenting or bad parenting? And the thing I love about this whole script is we're never told how to feel.
Yeah.
It's all...
I definitely feel like I interpreted it differently when watching the film than a lot of people, and I was like, uh-oh. But then I feel like other people are, like, feeling that way.
So.
I will say that as an adult, I was more angry that there were things that my parents lied to me about as a child than being like, oh, thank you for protecting me from that. Right. I was like, no, I would have preferred to have just known.
Yeah.
it's everything at once. It's a coming of age movie. Mm-hmm. It's a road movie. It's a family drama. And all of the themes of this movie ultimately becomes about sort of the dumb plight of winning obsessed culture, like how America's obsessed with winning. And like Michael Arndt talked about this movie and the scene, and he says, I wanted to think about the ultimate dumbest competition to totally undermine this theme of winning throughout the movie. And he said, a child beauty pageant is the dumbest thing to want to win. So like that becomes the sort of the underlying theme throughout the whole movie. And
if only he knew that Honey Boo Boo would come out.
I know.
Is this film better than something? Was it just first, or was it better than something like Way Way Back, or even other like more recent indies like Florida Project, or things that have like that borderline tone of...
I think Little Miss Sunshine was one of the first to really kind of toy with that tone.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Is it better, or is it just because it's first?
I think it might be both, honestly. Yeah. I think one thing... I mean, it definitely is first, but one of the things about Little Miss Sunshine was it was kind of a cultural phenomenon when it came out. Even the soundtrack alone became so popular when I was in college that it was just like, even if you didn't know the movie, you knew the music to it.
Yeah.
And it showed, like, everyone at different stages of life. So you see, like, Olive as a kid and kind of learning about the world. And you see, like, Richard and Frank at that point where you're kind of, like, wanting to give up in the world. And you see the son, whose name I'm
blanking. Dwayne.
You see him at that point where it's,
Paul
like,
Dano.
He's just right at the beginning of adulthood. And he hasn't really had his dreams crushed yet. And then you see his dreams get crushed, like, in the middle of the movie.
Yeah.
And then you see the grandfather, who doesn't give a fuck. because he's, like, shooting up heroin. And he's, like, because I'm old and it doesn't matter if I live or die.
Right.
And I'm like, oh. That's when I realized that when you're old, you can do whatever you want because you're a genius.
Can't wait. Right.
Jeff, who's your favorite character in this show?
It's funny, I always love Toni Collette. She's actually the least developed in the writing, but she's so good. It's also such an important turn for Steve Carell, like, because he's become, you know, Foxcatcher, he's become a movie star, but this was the first time I think he proved he was that
first time
round.
He did a serious role.
What I love about this is when you read the script, when you read these, what is it, four pages, five pages, when you read these pages, I don't know, this morning when I was reading, I was just like, this is just
incredible writing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, there's just something about it. Even if it's like, I don't really care about the story, but just to how well these five pages are written, you're like, I want to watch this movie.
Yes. Yeah. You just, that's exactly I have how to. I feel. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm excited for you to watch
it. I am too. I'm really excited to see this movie.
There's some surprises that you're really going to enjoy.
I hope I didn't spoil
ones that they just blew for you.
Well, I mean, whatever. It's fine. So many more. Like, there's, it's, yeah. It's, I mean,
which
it's,
we, which we don't need to talk about.
We don't need to talk about.
No, I'm excited to see the movie. Sorry. Thank you for bringing that in.
You're welcome. Yeah,
it's like when someone
it.
Ruined Usual Suspects for me, and I was like,
oh, well, that's a rough one.
Well, I'm glad we read that. Very well read, everyone. I think it's the rare example of an indie that's really great. And to answer your question, Roxy, I think it is rare that an everything comes together like this. I think Garden State gets close.
I was literally the third thing that I was going to list, but that came prior to this.
Yeah. I think. So they happen. They're rare, but movies like this can't happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Arkin won for it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Garden State was prior to
Little
Miss Sunshine?
Yeah.
But his next one was after. Mm-hmm. Whatever that was called. I Was Never Really Here. Wish You Were Here.
Wish You
we were All Here.
Something
is
like
that the one with Joaquin?
No, that's
I'm not.
I just saw that one too.
I'm not.
Never.
Yeah.
That's also never really here.
It's
good. Was Wish
what
you
year
were
did
here.
This come out?
That one was creepy.
2002. Earlier.
No,
I
it's when we were in high school. Yeah. When I was in high school.
Either way, you should watch it. All right, guys, we're going to move on. Very well read. Next, we're going to read Haley's scene, and we're reading Sorkin himself.
Yes, I picked a scene from The Newsroom. So it's just between two people. Sorry, I didn't think that the rest of you were very generous in picking scenes with everyone. But I really like... Okay, great. I like a lot of Sorkin stuff. I think The Newsroom, for me, was perfectly done. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just enough where you don't, like, other stuff has good parts, but it goes on too long for me. Like, The Newsroom was, like, the perfect amount of time, and the length of the show, really good. So this scene in particular...
Best pilot ever.
Is
yeah,
just,
absolutely.
This scene is just between Jim and Maggie, who are, like, a sort of will-they-won't-they-get-together romance in the show. And I may have cut out one line, so all apologies to Lord Sorkin.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes.
Did you audition for this?
No. I have used it in, like, a class
why
and
is
stuff,
it watermarked?
And that's why it was, for some reason,
I was wondering
it was,
the same thing.
I know, it's so, it looks, I'm a tool. I used it, I had to send it somewhere and... There's
I watermark all scripts with my name on them.
Nice.
Just to
I love it.
Thanks. Anyway, let's just read it.
Okay. So we have who's reading for Jim?
I'm Jim.
Andrew's reading for Jim, and Haley's reading for Margaret.
What happened on the call?
I swear, I kept my personal feelings to myself. I was on the phone with Glenn Fisher, and it was really just by the book.
Okay, so. Pre-interview's going fine when all of a sudden...
Things happen, Jim, okay, that are beyond your super newsman powers of understanding.
I wish you had told me that you dated Glenn Fisher in college.
How could you possibly know that?
He told me, which is what you should have done.
I know, but I thought you'd take it away from me.
I would have.
That's why I didn't tell you.
You have to tell me if you've had a relationship with...
It wasn't a relationship. We went out 4 times, and now he's the press aide to the governor of a state that gave us Barry Goldwater and a football team that couldn't find the end zone with an OnStar system.
You're a football fan now?
No, I looked it up. Also, the fourth date didn't count.
Is the fourth date relevant to the pre-interview?
It might be.
What happened on the fourth date?
We went back to his dorm room. We started making out a little, and then there was this crazy banging on the door. It was his ex-girlfriend, and she was shouting, "I know you've got some slut in there!" I think she meant me.
Yeah.
And Glenn said, "Get under the bed." So I got under the bed, and he let his ex-girlfriend in, and the two of them patched things up.
With you under the bed.
Yeah.
And when you say they patched things
up... Yes! Oh my god, they did it, Jim, okay? They settled their differences, and it didn't take very long because, as it turns out, Glenn doesn't take very long.
Compared to who?
Compared to other people and what I've read about in movies? It doesn't matter.
5 minutes?
I didn't have a stopwatch on him, but I know it was under 2 minutes because I was holding my breath. Is this important?
I don't know what's important yet. Fast forward to the call.
Glenn said the governor would also like to talk about Arizona doing well in Obama's Race to the Finish initiative.
And you said to Glenn?
How appropriate for you.
Good one.
Thank you.
You said you didn't inject any of your personal feelings.
About the bill. I didn't inject any personal opinions about the bill.
Okay, first of all, the initiative is called Race to the Top, not Race to the Finish.
I know, and that's why I was so sure God was on my side, because he teed me up so perfectly.
Oh, Sorkin.
It's so funny. They say writers always borrow from other... Like, no writer invents their own style, but, like, you could argue Aaron Sorkin, like, literally invented this way of writing.
Quippy.
I like this. Yeah, some of my favorite stuff is, like, this kind of style. This, and I would say, like, Gilmore Girls kind of walked this style line. I really like it. It's not really how we interact in real life. Nobody, like, is this quick really back and forth all the time, but I am so entertained by
improvisers
it.
To an exhausting degree. Where it's like, okay.
Line, yeah, maybe it's annoying in real life, but so entertaining to watch.
The line that Margaret says, it wasn't a relationship, we went four times in the football team, OnStar system, like, that might be the most Sorkin line ever. Because it's so brilliant, it's funny, the football reference,
the whole character, like, she's encapsulated in this scene as, like, she gets quips and she's, like, trying to hold her own, but she's, like, clearly the underdog and, like, always shit on. She's the kind of girl that will hide under the bed in this scenario. Like, so, like, she gets to have these zingers, except still she's that girl that's, like, still getting kicked or whatever. So I really like it. I think it's fascinating.
If someone tells you to hide under the bed, you don't do it?
Fuck no.
No way, man.
I go to the closet. It's like a default.
That's hilarious.
Nah.
I think I would just hide under the bed.
We're on a date. Screw that. Yeah.
I love that, Roxy, you asked... oh my gosh.
Haley,
thank you. I'm like looking at all these names. If you have auditioned with this, because I can see you as Alison Peele is you. You are Alison Peele. That's like fascinating to me.
God, that's great.
Yeah, really well read.
I don't think I'd go under the bed. I changed my mind.
There you go,
think
Rox.
You would just
join me in the closet, darling. Join me in the closet.
I could see you yelling, I'm not a slut! Back through the door.
Yeah.
I didn't have a stopwatch on it, but I know it was under 2 minutes because I was holding my breath.
Yeah.
It's just, God, it's so good.
The thing that he does, because I agree there is some Gilmore Girls in here. You know, you brought in Nora Ephron last time, which probably is an
influence. I got a style.
It's good. No,
I think we all kind of have style.
A flavor we like,
farcical British comedy.
Yeah.
Sad, funny, indeed.
I don't think I have a style.
What did I bring in last time?
I brought in Breaking Bad.
That's right.
Yeah.
Getting back to this, though, one thing Sorkin does, which I think is so smart, is he'll have characters address questions that were asked like half a page ago. Or like address, like it happens here where he's like, did you just say, where they'll talk about something then throw back.
Right.
And he's managing four trains of thought at once, and somehow I can follow it. Like, audiences can follow it.
It doesn't dumb it down for you, which is what I like. Like, there's so much, not to trash 1,000 writers, but, like, so much, like, procedural stuff or, like, network stuff that is, like, so by the book assumes you're an idiot. And it's insulting to watch, even when everyone's great. But, like, it's just, this assumes you're smart and can follow. And I love that.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Any other thoughts about this scene from the newsroom before you move on?
Let's watch the pilot if you haven't.
Watch the entire show.
It's only
episode,
two seasons.
Three
seasons. Sorry, thank you.
I don't know.
Or just watch the monologue from the pilot.
Yeah.
If you want to really dumb it down.
It's a great show.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for bringing that in, Haley. Very well read. Sorkin's not easy to act.
Thank you.
Yeah, good job.
Yeah, you crushed that, Haley.
So many words.
It is. One last question I have, though, for actors. Actors say that even though it's so many words, Sorkin still does know how to write for actors.
Yeah, definitely.
He really does. And I noticed that because almost all of Jim's lines, he's getting cut off, which is exactly what would happen in this situation. Yeah. And it's another thing that, as an actor, what's really... I don't know why I did that. When you notice good writing is when lines aren't finished and you can easily keep talking.
Yeah.
Even though you have no idea the context or the situation. Like, any line here that you were supposed to cut me off, I could have went on another sentence.
Yeah. Well, also, I think all the words are for a purpose. They're extending. Yeah. Like, we're learning more. It's not the soap opera thing of we are filling this time by saying, you and I both know what you have done before. And now this thing, like, it's not necessary.
It's not clunky. I think actors, the thing is that we want good dialogue sounds like how people talk in real life. Yeah. And you can tell when somebody's overthought a line of dialogue because it no longer makes sense to say it aloud. It's kind of like, well, okay, why are you saying you all this? And, like, we don't use someone's name that often. Like, I can't think of the last time, you know, I've been like, well, Jeff, how's your day going, Jeff? Yeah. Oh, that's so good to know, Jeff. Yeah. And, like, you know, we don't do that kind of stuff. And so it's nice. The natural can get, even if it's, like, you're going as fast as possible, like, it's still
It's easy to hit all the beats.
You can hear the rhythm and you can hit the beats.
It's heightened but grounded, which is like so hard to do. Cool, that was like really great, guys. Like Shakespeare, that's a good point. Okay, so let's go ahead and read this final scene brought in by Ms. Roxy Stryer.
God, so good.
All right, I looked it up because I felt bad not giving credit where credit was due.
I love it.
You guys all did. So this was directed by Stephen Merchant and written by Greg Daniels.
Perfect.
And it is season 5, episode 6 of The Office. And I picked it because it's funny. That's about it. Honestly, I think the show is really funny. And it's not even my favorite sitcom, but it just does what it does so well.
Yeah.
And that's cool.
Did you transcribe this?
Yeah.
You did? Okay, well, so that's what I was going to ask about.
Crappily.
Well, no, you did a very good job, and that's what I was saying, is because it was so funny to read, and I was like, I know that there's got to be improv in there and drafts that were much different before they shot, so I just wanted to ask you that real quick.
Yeah, I transcribed this, but I did leave out some, like, ums, buts, things that I was like, I don't think that was there. I don't know. They would have could. Anyway, so I'm going to be playing Jim, because why not, you know? And Andrew's going to be playing Michael, and Tim's going to be playing Dwight.
Awesome. So guys, this is The Office, Season 5, Episode 6. Dwight, Jim, and Michael sit around a conference table. Michael is having Jim and Dwight make mock sales phone calls.
Here's what's going to happen. I am going to have to fix you. Manage you two on a more personal scale. A micro form of management. Jim, what's that called?
Micro-jimmin'.
Now, Jim is going to be the client. Dwight, you're going to have to sell to him without being aggressive, hostile, or difficult. Let's go.
All right. Fine.
Dwight picks up the phone and fake calls Jim. Jim picks up.
Hello.
Hello, this is Dwight Schrute from the Dunder Mifflin Paper Company.
That's great, because I need paper.
Excellent. Then you are in luck, because we are having a limited time offer only on everything.
Wow, this is my lucky day.
Ask him his name.
What's your name, sir?
I am Bill Buttlicker.
Really? That's your real name?
How dare you? My family built this country, by the way.
Be respectful, Dwight.
Yes, Michael.
Would you hold on a second? That's my other line.
Jim pretends to pick up another line.
Hello? No, I'm just on the phone with this stupid salesman. He's so dumb. I'm probably just going to keep him on the line forever and not buy anything.
It's up to you. It's up to you to change his mind.
Sorry, that was a family emergency.
Oh, no. What's wrong?
You know what? That's private.
Boundaries, Dwight. Come on.
I'm sorry, Mr. Buttlicker. As I was saying, we're
You'll have to speak a bit louder. I'm hard of hearing.
He's an old man.
As I was saying, right now,
we're going to have to talk louder.
Our prices have never been lower.
You're going to have to talk louder?
Never been lower.
Louder, son.
Buttlicker, our prices have never been lower.
Stop it. That is totally inappropriate. You never yell at the client. Never yell at the client.
Now you listen to me, sir.
Oh, here we go.
The three words I would describe you as are aggressive, hostile, and definitely difficult.
Please, Mr. Buttlicker.
I am irate right now.
Please, give me another chance, Mr. Buttlicker.
Give me the phone.
I've to put you on with my boss now.
Dwight hands Michael the phone.
Well, I should hope so. Who is this?
Hello, this is Michael Scott, regional manager.
This is William M. Buttlicker.
Oh, hello, Mr. Buttlicker. How can I help you?
Michael, I like the sound of your voice. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to buy $1 million worth of paper products today.
You see how it's done? Thank you very much, sir. I don't think you'll regret it.
You're the master.
There is one condition, Michael.
Yes?
You have to fire the salesman who treated me so terribly.
Don't do it, Michael!
It's $1 million sale.
Oh, good job, guys. Loved it.
Oh, my God.
Do you want to talk at all first, Rox, before the rest of us jump all over
it? No, it's just silly and fun.
It's like, so funny.
Honestly, I'm not, like, usually the biggest potty humor person in the crew, but it's just when you do it right, it's funny.
Yeah.
It's funny. I feel like so many different people, so many different walks of life at different ages, like, sometimes you just need to laugh because things are just so serious. And, like, this is just a joke. Like, a joke, and Jim doesn't take anything seriously. And that's, I feel like, a lot of people in their 9-to-5s, which is just like, this is not, I don't care.
Absolutely.
Okay, answer me this. Sorry to cut you
off. You're
good, no. So everybody's been telling me to watch The Office because I've seen like an episode here and there, later episodes, like
how
now.
Have you not seen
anything?
I know.
So I went back on Netflix and I watched the first 3 episodes and I don't like it, you guys.
Season 1's bad.
So I'm asking, like, is it just the season one that's bad?
It's something about Greg Daniels and his first seasons of things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You could tell people, If you want to just know who the people are, yeah, you can start first season. But usually with him, like even with Parks and Rec, you can skip to second season. Yeah.
I mean, Parks and Rec is the worst first season of all time.
Yeah.
And I think that there's – I really like The Office. I would not say it's in my top 10
favorite comedies. It's good. The episodes that are amazing are just the best ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the ones that aren't, there's so many episodes. Like, they had to fill so much time. But you do get invested in the relationships, and that's what ends up mattering.
And I think they felt pressure to not be a direct copy of the original Office.
Yeah.
Which, you know, only had, I think it was only on for 2 seasons, if even, because it's British, and they're like, we're done.
Yeah. Right.
Well, I actually went back and watched, because that's on Netflix as well, and I was like, well, let me compare. Maybe the British one is funny in the first season, and I didn't really like the one either.
And it might also just not be your style of humor, too.
Yeah, totally.
Like, well, and also like, with The Office, like, and with Parks and Rec, the characters really, truly evolve, even though they're like, wow, what is the word I'm trying to say? The outline is here in the first season, but they really grow and evolve, and like they do all these own things that you just fall in love with, and you know it's what the actors bring to those characters.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I think the first season of The American Office tried to capture a British sensibility,
mm-hmm.
and Steve Carell can't really be a dick like
Ricky Gervais.
Like Ricky Gervais. Yeah. And so the show gets sweeter. Yeah. Like the first season's mm-hmm. really, because have you seen Parks and Rec?
No.
Okay. These are shows that are like just kind of warm comedies. Mm-hmm. And The Office isn't always a sweet show, but season one was pretty acerbic. Whereas even here, it's this conflict-oriented scene, but it's goofy and silly. Yeah. And that's when the show works best.
I almost picked a scene from, there was a bunch of scenes I almost picked from The Office. One of them, I don't know if you guys remember Prison Mike.
Yes.
Like, they're so offensive that, like, if you take it standalone, I was like, I don't know if we care. Not that I don't believe in us, but, like, there were some scenes about, like, Oscar and, like, him not wanting to come out of the closet and Michael, like, completely outing him. Or, like, there were, like, racist moments and sexist moments. And I was like, if they didn't do it so perfectly on the show,
you have to really know who Michael is.
Yeah.
You can't walk in on one of those episodes where Michael's just being a total dick.
So this was, like, as dicky as he could be in a table read with people understanding that he still has a heart.
Yes. It's a good choice for a scene. And Greg Daniels also created the show, so you did a good job of honoring the writer who made the world.
I think that, like, Michael Scott is probably, like, the most unique and maybe the hardest character for anyone else to play. Because, like, when the show came out, people like Rogan and Odenkirk and and tons of other, like, really heavy hitters in the comedy business all audition, and they're not good. Like, they're just bad auditions. Like, you watch them, and it's not their fault. It's just that, and then you watch Carell's, and it's just like, oh, my God.
There it is.
Like, this is incredible. So even me reading this, it felt like I sweat. Because I got nervous. Because it's such big shoes to fill.
It's hard.
It's like what, I've already used this quote. Oh. Who's the guy from Inglourious Basterds, the villain?
Christoph Waltz.
Christoph Waltz. Have I already used this quote? I hope not. But on Comedians Getting Coffee, he was talking about how, like, he's like, any actor who isn't right for the role is probably just going to be bad. You're going to see it and think they're a bad actor. It's not that they're bad. It's just they're not the character.
Agreed.
And I was like, that's so true.
Or maybe they're bad.
Or maybe they're really bad.
That can happen too.
Rox, you brought up the potty humor element.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I think the reason it works here is because it's positioned in a specific character-driven way.
Yeah.
So, like, I was trying to think, if this scene were happening with, well, it would be funny with Angela because she would hate this. But if it were happening with, like, Andy, it probably wouldn't play funny. So it's like, if you're going to resort to vulgarity, you have to position it in a way where the character is using it. There's an added level of comedy.
Yeah.
So hearing Dwight have to, like, stoop down to Jim's joke is really what makes this funny.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Dwight hates it, but Dwight's also committed to getting Michael's approval.
Exactly. Right, because the funniest part about this scene is, like, it's not the name, it's not the butt licker, it's the fact that, like, Jim is, like, pioneering the worst sales customer ever, and that Michael and Dwight are just like, it's a real, like, let me talk to him.
Yeah.
This is Michael's, you know, like, the butt licker, it's the climax, his butt licker prices have never been lower. Him screaming that is, like, that's the potty humor climax, but, it's just so good.
It's so like classic funny network comedy.
Yeah.
It's great.
John Krasinski is so good in his delivery of everything with Jim because he says it with such a straight face.
Yeah.
And he recently talked about how he, like, insulted The Office in front of Greg Daniels when he was auditioning for it. Did you guys hear about that?
No.
About how he's like, when I first went into audition, you know, this guy I didn't know came up to me and asked me what I thought. And he's like, oh, well, you know, the British one's so good. I'm just afraid Americans were just going to come in and screw it up. And then he found out later it was Greg Daniels. I was like, yes.
Wow. He probably appreciated that because he's like, yeah, I hope we do it.
I fear this, yeah.
A similar story is when Susan Sarandon was going to do Feud with Ryan Murphy, she wasn't going to take the part. And they sat down and got dinner, and Susan Sarandon said, you know, I'm just really scared to do this. And Ryan Murphy said, I'm very scared to do it, too. Yeah. And that was the moment Susan Sarandon knew she wanted to take the role.
Oh, yeah.
So I think, like, that transparency can actually be really powerful among artists and creatives, because I think it creates a sense of shared safety.
And yeah, and you can do it together.
You can do it together. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Any other thoughts about this script of The Office? Oh. Very well read. Thanks for bringing it in.
So good.
You play a good straight man, Rox. That was fun.
Thanks,
I'm
man.
Used to you playing big characters. You've been doing Groundlings, but that was fun. Yeah, you
crushed
really
Jim,
well.
Yeah.
I think if you do watch The Office, start with the Dundies in season two.
Okay.
Is the one I would start with.
Okay.
Any other thoughts on any of these scenes, guys, before we kind of make our way out? Great. Well, I thought this was really fun. Yeah. Very well selected, guys.
This is always fun.
Episode 51, baby.
51.
Yeah.
Celebrating the
50s. I can't believe it.
We're doing a movie next week, guys, and it's actually about Oprah. We're doing an Oprah biopic, but it's not about her whole life. It's about one very specific month of her life.
I got Oprah. No,
yeah.
I don't know. Everybody gets her.
I know. I just looks at Adrian.
So it's good. I know that's going to be a high pressure.
Sure.
I want to play Stedman.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
It's interesting. He's actually
you're just standing beside her quietly.
Yes.
That's all he does.
No lines.
Yeah. Interestingly, he's not even in it, though. It's about Oprah, but it's also about it's about her show and this very weird couple months where she got embroiled in this mad cow disease court case. So,
interesting. Yeah,
long time ago.
Forgot about mad cow disease.
I know, but it's really interesting. It's a lot about.
Never mind. I'm not going to say that because Oprah will find me.
She'll find you. But it's cool. It's about race and class and sort of what it was like to be a woman running a huge media mogul empire. Mm. So it's good. It's smart.
Cool.
It's thematically driven, and I'm excited about it. So that'll be next week, Friday at 9 a.m. because it's a feature, and I'll send that out today, guys. But this has been the Unproduced Table Read. The show we ran was a little different. If this is your first time tuning in, we read produced work. Again, we normally read unproduced work, and we interview their writers. So come back here for a script and an interview next week. My name is Jeff, guys. Thanks for tuning in. If you want to connect with me online and pitch me a script, you can do that at Jeffrey C. Graham.
I am Timothy Mike. Michael, you can find me everywhere at I Am Timothy Mike. Thank you, Shonda Rhimes, for giving us Grey's Anatomy.
Yes.
I'm Roxy Stryer. You can find me at Roxy Stryer.
I am Haley O'Connor. That's Haley with two Y's. If you don't use two Y's, you're not too wise.
I'm Adrian Snow. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Miss Adrian Snow.
I'm Andrew Guy. Bye.
Bye. See you next week, guys.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk. Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network. We would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.